Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest act of pettiness from a thin-skinned, petulant president who today announced that he was considering revoking the security clearances of his critics, naming six former top intelligence officials, former CIA head John Brennan, former FBI head James Comey, former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, former National Security Advisor Susan Rice, former National Security Agency head Michael Hayden, and former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. Locke Johnson, the Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia, who served on the senior staffs of both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees and is the author of Spy Watching, Intelligence Accountability in the United States, joins us to discuss this latest effort to distract the press and feed Trump's base with more imaginary mendacity from the deep state. Since both McCabe and Comey no longer have security clearances, the hollow nature of the ploy is already apparent. And as the New York Times recently revealed, Trump was told of Russia's meddling in the election and of possible compromise Putin has on him in briefings by Brennan, Clapper, and Comey 2 weeks before taking office. But ever since then, as Trump keeps repeating no collusion, he appears haunted by what these deep state top officials who briefed him know. Could that be why he is going after them? Then we'll speak with Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. He joins us to discuss Trump's threatening tweet in capital letters to Iran's president in response to Rouhani's threat of, quote, a mother of all wars if the United States keeps pressuring customers not to buy Iranian oil. We will assess Secretary of State Pompeo's remarks that Iran is a mafia state run by hypocrites in clerical robes who are stealing the country blind, something the Iranian people already know. Then finally, with the latest NBC Wall Street Journal poll showing Trump is going up with 45% now supporting him and with 88% support from Republicans, in spite of negative reactions to Trump's border policies and his performance at the recent press conference with Putin. We will speak with Henry Olson, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and author of Working Class Republicans, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue Collar Conservatism. He joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, What Liberals Still Get Wrong About Trump's Support, and how Republicans don't care about who Trump is, but rather like what he does. And joining us now is Locke Johnson, Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia. He served on the senior staffs of both the House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees and is the editor of the journal Intelligence and National Security. He has written several books on American foreign policy, including Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Quest for Security, The Threat on the Horizon, an inside account of America's search for security after the Cold War. And his latest book is Spy Watching, Intelligence Accountability in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Locke Johnson.
Hello, Ian. It's always great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Locke. And what do you make of this idea? Apparently, Senator Rand Paul, we know that he's been beating the drum about taking away John Brennan's security clearance because apparently in the 1970s, John Brennan voted for the head of the American Communist Party as a kind of protest vote. That was the original reason, but apparently he met with Trump today, and then after that meeting, Trump, through his spokesperson, Sarah Sanders, said that he's considering revoking security clearances of these top officials, General Hayden, Comey, Clapper, Susan Rice, McCabe, and Brennan.
Yes, you know, these people that have been chosen to be on the so-called enemies list, as many people are calling it, reminiscent of Richard Nixon's list of people he didn't like, is an odd list to be considered enemies. These are kind of salt-of-the-earth people. These individuals like Clapper and Brennan and so on have been the heads of our most important intelligence agencies, trusted with the nation's top secrets. And they're quite conservative in their own personal lives. I know from reading biographies about them. Take Jim Clapper, for example. He grew up in a conservative family and sent his children to Liberty University and has been conservative all his life, but he is a professional intelligence officer and has served well both Democrats and Republicans as intelligence officers are supposed to do. So to go after these people is quite strange. And I must say, Rand Paul, you really have to wonder about him. He was even the other day criticizing John McCain as someone who hadn't been right on anything for 40 years. John McCain is a great national hero. So you have to wonder what's going on with Rand Paul. Well, he's not fighting with his neighbors. He's really discrediting a lot of good people. But I think this is quite alarming to have the president have an enemies list like this. And this is a vendetta. This is a retaliation because these people on the list have criticized Trump. And they've done so rather reluctantly because they're not kind of the kind of people who are bomb throwers. They don't like to criticize the president. They are loyal, patriotic individuals. But they have felt compelled to speak out when Trump has so erroneously commented on national security issues, such as still failing to believe that the Russians tampered with our 2016 presidential election, which every organization that's looked into that so far, most notably so far the Senate Intelligence Committee, and of course later the Mueller Special Counsel investigation, has found that there was indeed tampering. Exactly the extent of the tampering, we won't know for sure until Mueller reports. But for the president to deny that and to cozy up to Putin after he's insulted every important democratic ally we have in the world is passingly strange, to say the least.
Well, we learned recently from the New York Times that on January the 6th of 2017, most of these officials briefed Donald Trump 2 weeks before he came into office. And, of course, after Brennan and Clapper and General Rogers had briefed him, or Admiral Rogers had briefed him, he then went into a private briefing with Comey, where Comey talked about the infamous Steele dossier. But the fact that he was told then about Russia's meddling and given top secret intel on that, naming Russian GRU officers, etc., and really solid stuff, apparently. Ever since then, my sense is he's been haunted by these very same officials as though they know something that he knows, or they probably know more than he knows, and he doesn't like it. And he's been on this jag about no collusion, no collusion, no collusion, when indeed he was told 2 weeks before he went into office that there was collusion. So how do you interpret that?
Well, I think you're right about that, and I think he's very paranoid that someone's going to think that the only reason he became president is because the Russians tilted the election in his favor. Whether or not that's true, I don't know, and the Mueller investigation will help us find out exactly what the role of the Russians was and how important it was in leading to Hillary Clinton's defeat. But I think that haunts him. He's such an egomaniac, and everything is about him. He doesn't have the dignity of the office of the presidency that we normally have. It's most unfortunate that we're dealing with someone who just doesn't have much of an emotional maturity here. And back to these people on his so-called enemies list, you know, these are people who are playing a very important role, even in retirement. They are still consulting with these intelligence agencies, and they bring just a wealth of wisdom and experience. And so to try and cut them off from the opportunity to rub shoulders and be wise men, or in the case of Susan Rice, a wise woman, to help current people in office have a better understanding of national security and good decision-making is quite unfortunate. These people are important to our national security, even though they've gone into retirement, and they're very active in being called out to the CIA and the NSA and the other agencies to talk about their 40, 50 years of experience. This is extremely important, particularly, Ian, since, as you know, a lot of our intelligence is outsourced. So a lot of it goes to some of these private organizations that do contract work for the government, and Jim Clapper and others are consulting with these companies, and they're again providing corporate memories so that we can make in the United States better decisions about the world.
And again, I'm speaking with Locke Johnson, who's Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia. He served on the senior staffs of both the House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees and is the editor of the journal Intelligence and National Security. And he is the author of The Threat on the Horizon, an inside account of America's search for security after the Cold War. And his latest book is Spy Watching: Intelligence Accountability in the United States. Now, the spokesperson for Andrew McCabe pointed out that, first of all, Andrew McCabe lost his security clearances when he was terminated. And as you know, he was terminated in a rather crude and, I thought, somewhat cruel manner just before his literally hours before his pension became due. She went on to say, you would think the White House would check this with the FBI before trying to throw shiny objects to the press corps. And that's what I mentioned in the opening. Yeah. I keep feeling, just as someone who's trying to cover Trump on a daily basis, that you are always being manipulated, that they always throw out some piece of raw meat for the press to gnaw on. And it does feel like a kind of systemic form of distraction.
I think so, too. And can you imagine, Ian, the chilling effect it has on American citizens when the White House tries to denigrate people who have merely exercised their First Amendment rights to speak their opinions about how the government is working? I mean, that's the whole essence of the United States, to have that freedom of expression. And here you've got a president who's beginning to develop an enemies list of anyone who speaks against him. Where does that lead to? Who else is going to be on that list? If people like Jim Clapper, who's served this nation for 50 years as an intelligence officer, it can be put on an enemies list, then any one of us can. It has a very chilling effect on democracy in this country, I think.
Well, it does add to the evidence that's out there that Donald Trump has these kind of autocratic tendencies, and perhaps is why he's so in such a swoon over Vladimir Putin.
Yes, it seems that way. And, of course, if you look around the world right now, the lamp lights of democracy are flickering everywhere. It's quite alarming. Poland, Hungary, you know, the list is long. And even Germany, one of our top allies, is under assault as right-wing groups begin to rise there. It's almost reminiscent of the latter days of the Weimar Republic when they had similar problems. So it's incumbent upon all the rest of us to stand strong, to make sure that our democracy doesn't falter by speaking against these efforts by our president and his aides to denigrate upstanding American citizens like Clapper and Brennan and Susan Rice and all the rest. We cannot just stand by passively while this happens.
Well, just in the last minute, had President Trump been a normal president after having been briefed about Russian interference 2 weeks before he became president, the first thing he would have done would be to have a national address and say, you know, we've learned that the Russians have interfered in our elections. We're going to have a full inquiry into this, and it's never going to happen again on my watch. That's what a normal president would have done.
Exactly.
So do you – everybody's anticipating the Mueller report. Do you think the Mueller report will give that kind of clarity that was necessary from day one?
I think it will. You know, he's a very serious, objective individual, well-liked by Republicans and Democrats, and did a great job when he was FBI director. And he's got a staff of some of the best attorneys in the country and other researchers who are really tracking down the evidence. So when he presents his report, it's going to be a serious, objective effort to come to the truth about all these matters that you and I have been talking about. So I think we all look forward to getting that report so we can put more perspective on exactly what's been happening.
Well, Locke Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
A pleasure to be with you, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Locke Johnson, who is Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia. He served on the senior staffs of both the House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees and is the editor of the journal Intelligence and National Security. He has written several books on American foreign policy, including Bombs, Bugs, Drugs and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Quest for Security, The Threat on the Horizon, An Inside Account of America's Search for Security After the Cold War. And his latest book is Spy Watching: Intelligence Accountability in the United States. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into exchanges of threats between President Trump and Iran's president. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com and the author of Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thank you, Ian.
And President Trump tweeted out today, mostly in caps, to Iranian President Rouhani, and this is where it's all caps, "Never, ever threaten the United States again, or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. We are no longer a country that will stand for your demented words of violence and death. Be cautious." So I guess if you put it in caps, it's more manly, is it? I mean, is this some kind of penis measuring contest between Trump and Rouhani?
Well, both of them are escalating rhetoric in a way that, to say the least, is unwise. I don't know. The typical etiquette on Twitter is that you don't use all caps like that unless you're a maniac, and. It's not that Trump usually obeys the rules of the Internet. On the other hand, he is replying to a statement by Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. Rouhani was at a conference, and he said to Trump, addressing him, apostrophizing him, and saying that peace with Iran is the mother of all peace, and war with Iran is the mother of all war. Which sounds like an echo of Saddam Hussein from the Gulf War, and it took a lot of people aback in the Middle East because the Iranians hate Saddam Hussein, and to have the president of Iran kind of echo him seemed strange, and it also seemed like an undue escalation of rhetoric towards the United States, since despite the destruction of the nuclear deal by the U.S., so far no military actions have been taken.
Right, but isn't it true that the Iranians are very concerned that by November the Americans are working hard to cut off all of their oil customers and the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, and I believe even the government itself have said that if this happens, they'll close the Strait of Hormuz?
Yes, Hassan Rouhani himself said that. He's been known as a centrist. He negotiated twice, both in the early zeros and again under Obama, with the West over the civilian nuclear enrichment program in Iran. And he hasn't, in the last couple of months, been talking like a centrist any longer. He's saying these wild things. You know, the fact is the Iranians can't close the Straits of Hormuz. They don't really have a navy, and although it's narrow, it's not that narrow, like 21 miles or something at its shortest, it would not be possible for them to close it in the first place. In the second place, the last time that severe sanctions were applied to Iran under Obama, they reduced the exports from 2.5 million barrels a day to about 1.5 million. They took about 1 million barrels a day off the market and made Iran keep it in the ground and lose that income. But you would still want to export the 1.5 million barrels a day, which goes out through the Straits of Hormuz. So you'd be cutting your nose off to spite your face if you did that. It's empty talk, and it's very dangerous empty talk.
Well, yesterday on my program, I had a psychiatrist who's one of the contributors to a book put out by Yale, or originated out of a conference at Yale of a group of mental health professionals and psychiatrists looking at the case of Donald Trump, the dangerous case of Donald Trump. And he said that Trump is, as we all know, a narcissist, and that there's a condition referred to as narcissistic mortification, which is when a narcissist is finally confronted by overwhelming truth. In this case, it would be truth of Trump's incredible incompetence and amateurism, not his grandiosity. So his own grandiosity is clashing with the reality, which is catching up on him as he tries to stay one step ahead of the sheriff, that this would result in Trump declaring war, literally, or starting a war to distract from this kind of psychological collision between his view of himself and the reality of his presidency.
Well, it's not impossible that Trump will try to find a way of ratcheting up tensions with Iran in particular as a way of distracting from his domestic problems. It doesn't require that he have an architectonic neurotic breakdown over his narcissism. It's just wagging the dog. Lots of presidents have done it. And indeed, Trump used to regularly accuse President Obama of being on the verge of going to war with Iran as a distraction from his low poll numbers back a few years ago. So Trump has this on his mind, that presidents do these things. And I think the other thing to say, though, is that if Trump wanted to change the conversation, wanted to put Iran forward as a way of getting away from the Putin, Manafort, Russia investigation kind of issue, then he didn't do a very good job, because after he tweeted in caps to Rouhani, he went back to tweeting about Putin and the Russia investigation. So he seems to be perfectly happy to have it be a matter of conversation. And I don't think we can interpret his verbal threats to Iran, which, you know, reading between the lines, they were threats to bomb Iran with a nuclear weapon. That we can't interpret it as necessarily wagging the dog. It just seems to be more Trumpism.
And again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, who is a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com and the author of Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. So Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Sunday spoke at the Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California, where he described the Iranian regime as resembling the mafia more than a government, and adding that the goal of our efforts is to one day see Iranians in Iran enjoying the same quality of life that Iranians in America enjoy. Those that can get around the travel ban, right?
Yeah.
So tell me, what do you make of the outing the kleptocrats, the clerics, like the Supreme Leader, who Pompeo said has a $95 billion hedge fund?
Sure. Well, the problem, of course, is that the United States and Pompeo in particular are not actually bothered by this phenomenon in any other country. So Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel is under corruption investigation. The crown princes of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are both gathering up enormous amounts of wealth into their own hands, while spending on ordinary people is not necessarily a high priority. The Egyptian military junta has billions and is taking over the Egyptian economy. So, you know, all of those countries are praised as allies and you know, good nations and good friends. And so Pompeo only minds the inequities in the Iranian system because he's already got it in for Iran. It's not a principled objection. Not to mention that he is part of a kleptocratic billionaire administration himself. The tax cuts on the wealthy that they passed earlier this year, in and of themselves, will transfer $1.5 trillion to the super rich from ordinary people, cutting their services, cutting their health care, and so forth. So it seems to me a lot of what Pompeo said about Iran was kind of reflection theory. He accused them of being hypocritical clergymen, but then Pompeo is on the religious right in the United States, and the religious right is supporting Trump. So how hypocritical clergymen are they?
Well, is there any, I mean, these people, Pompeo and Trump and Bolton, they're not deft in any way. And Trump has made the stupidest threats, for example, using the U.S. military to invade Venezuela. All he does is help these tyrants and despots. And I'm sure there's a rally around the flag phenomenon going on in Iran. But that's not to say that the Iranian people, from what I understand, are absolutely disgusted with this government and they want to be freed from it. And the economy is in a tailspin and the young are very frustrated and the authorities are trying to shut down social media, which is one of the few ways they have to communicate. So if we had a more deft administration, there might well be a way to get this kind of information out to the Iranian people about their thieving mullahs running the country. Because
the Iranians know that their mullahs are thieving.
But they do. They don't need to be told.
I don't think this is going to come as a surprise.
I see. Because they got furious when the Iranian state budget was accidentally made public, and it revealed the enormous amounts of money that go to the clerics.
Yes, and to particular foundations. The problem with analyzing Iran in the United States is precisely that it's been put under the spotlight as an enemy nation. And so the interpretation seems to me to be skewed. You know, the French have enormous numbers of strikes. You know, the French truck drivers and rail drivers will just like shut down the country for 3 days. And sometimes in French factories, they even take the manager hostage as part of the negotiating tactics. This happens all the time. France is being, you know, roiled by these things. But nobody comes out and says, oh, well, the French government is on the verge of collapse and it's going to be overthrown any moment and so forth. So, yes, there, you know, have been demonstrations in Iran. The ones last January were surprising in that they were often in small rural towns or provincial towns away from the action. And not places that a lot of spotlight had been shined on, and there seemed to have been a lot of economic, in particular economic, grievances there. But it's not necessarily a sign that the government is about to fall. People have been predicting this for a long time. It's a fairly robust government. It has a big bureaucracy, and it has a big oil income, which goes straight to the state. So it is in the hands of the state officers. And when you say that the money in Iran is in the hands of the elite, well, part of the reason for that is that like 70% of the income comes from oil, and the oil is nationalized, so it's government oil. So these state officers have control of it. The saying that Iran is in a revolutionary situation seems to me without very much foundation. Again, as you rightly say, and threatening them like this is likely to, if anything, make people hold their noses and rally around the government.
So what could be going on here? One of the things that I've always found troubling is that Netanyahu and the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, MBS, both appear to want American boys and girls to die in a war against Iran, which they very much want. But they don't want to do it themselves. And that seems to be a very cynical situation. So what already it's been pretty evident that the Palestinians are being sold out anymore, because Arab states always made justice for the Palestinians a precondition for any dealings with Israel. And now Saudi Arabia is dealing with Israel without caring about the Palestinians. So Iran, to some extent, seems to have played a role in driving the Saudis closer to Israel. How do you see it?
Oh, certainly. The Saudis look out on the Middle East over the last 20 years, and they count up their losses. You had the Prime Minister of Lebanon 20 years ago was a dual Saudi native citizen, and
the guy that was blown up by Hezbollah.
Yes, yeah. Yes, but now Lebanon has to be counted as Iran territory, although the Saudis still have a hand in, and they still have a toehold in the Prime Minister's office. But that's shifted on them as Lebanon has gone over to the Iran side of the ledger, more or less. Syria likewise used to get Saudi aid, and it's now very heavily pro-Iranian. Iraq under Saddam was their ally in the Iran-Iraq war. Now Iraq is Shiite dominated and tilts towards Iran. The Houthis took over northern Yemen, and they are a kind of Shia, and the Saudis see them as Iranian cat's paws, although that's wildly exaggerated. But nevertheless, if you're looking out from Riyadh on the region, Turkey has much better relations with Iran than it does with Saudi Arabia. They've lost, and there's this wave of Iranian influence that's washed over the region, which has supplanted them. They've been pushed back, and so they're worried that the Iranians are coming for them. And the current crew, King Salman and his son, I think are genuinely concerned that the Iranians might try to overthrow them. They are afraid not only of Iran as a nation state, but of this idea of populist Islamic politics. So they group, a Sunni group like the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a grassroots movement, with Shiite Iran, even though the two don't have much in common. But what they do have in common is that they mobilize masses under the name of Islam against entrenched elites. And the Saudis feel they feel they've lost. They've been pushed back, and they're under siege by Iran. And they felt that the Obama and the United Nations Security Council deal with Iran in 2015 kind of gave an imprimatur to this new Iran-dominated Middle East in which the Saudis were marginalized. And some of the comments of Obama before he went out of office kind of reinforced this feeling that they had been sidelined. So I think they and the United Arab Emirates were part of the plot to put in Trump. I think that's a neglected part of the story. It's not just the Russians who wanted to change. Sure. And I think they're pleased as punch.
And you have to add Israel to that too.
Yes.
Netanyahu just was furious with Obama because Obama basically was saying, let's get out of the Middle East. It's been nothing but an ongoing disaster, and let's pivot towards Asia, which is the emerging power in the world in any case. And the last thing that the Israelis want is to be ignored. I mean, they're the most spoiled country on the planet because they get unlimited attention from the United States for a tiny little country. It's ridiculous. But just in closing, though, as far as we know, the only thing that's come out of this secret meeting between Putin and Trump was that the deal is being struck between Netanyahu and Putin, and that the Russians are promising to restrain the Iranians in post-Assad Syria, now that Assad has pretty much won the Syrian war. Now, to my mind, that's just ridiculous. What kind of guarantees could the Russians give? The Iranians aren't going to get out of Lebanon or Syria or Iraq, for that matter.
Right. I think what the Israelis want from the Russians is some kind of assurance that the Iranians won't, and their proxies, the Hezbollah and others, won't be allowed to come right onto the Syrian-Israeli border. The Russians, as I understand it from leaks, have told the Israelis that they're not able to remove Iran or Hezbollah from Syria at this point in any case, because although it's true that the government has increasingly seemed to win, there are still big swaths of the country that are under the control of the rebel opposition, including Idlib province in the north, where there are several million people outside of the government's control. My own guess is, and it is a horrible situation, but my own guess is that over the next year or two, the Syrian Arab Army, the Russian Air Force, and the Shiite militias like Hezbollah will make a move against those rebels in Idlib and conquer that last territory. And so since this is still a big battle to come and a prospect for the future, Putin is certainly not going to disinvite Iran or Hezbollah from Syria. They need that manpower.
Well, Juan Cole, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and the president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com and the author of Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Trump is going up in the polls and what liberals still get wrong about Trump's support. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Henry Olson, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and an editor at unheard.com. He is the author of The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue-Collar Conservatism. And he has an op-ed at The Guardian, What Liberals Still Get Wrong About Trump's Support. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Olson.
Thanks for having me on.
And the NBC and the Wall Street Journal just released a poll indicating that Donald Trump is going up in the polls. He's now at 45% approval. And also, it's up to 88% support amongst Republicans. So I'm sure that must be puzzling liberals who would be assuming, I imagine, that because of ripping children from their parents at the border and all of the controversy surrounding that and all of the controversy surrounding Trump's performance at the press conference in Helsinki, that his poll numbers would be in a nosedive. But they're not. So what explains that?
Well, you have to understand that for most Republicans, Trump is actually a pretty normal politician. That surprised a number of them who thought that he might not be, but he's made it very clear that he is giving each Republican faction their highest priority, tax cuts, Supreme Court justices, deregulation. And in return, most of the Republican Party and most of the Republican members are giving him their support, even if it's a little less voluble or strong as it might have been with the more conventional president.
So in other words, they don't care about who he is. They just care about what he does.
Most of them, that's the case. And he's making clear that he's not breaking faith with them and that he is doing what they would like done in government. The question of who he is was and how they would vote was answered 18 months ago when people stepped into the polling booth.
So in your article, you mentioned the book that you co-authored with Professor Dante Scala, The Four Faces of the Republican Party. Tell us about those four faces.
The four faces are factions of voters, not necessarily congressmen or congresswomen. They are moderates who used to be about 30% of the party and now are a little under a quarter. Religious conservatives who are about a quarter of the party. Fiscal and secular conservatives who are only about a tenth to a sixth of the party. And then the rest are kind of the generic Republican, somewhat conservative, the sort of person who would prefer Mitch McConnell or John Boehner to Ted Cruz or Rand Paul.
But what I found extraordinary about your research is that the 2016 exit polls showed that Trump won because he decisively beat Clinton amongst the 18% of Americans who did not like either candidate. You referred to these as the reluctant Trump voters. So what happened there, and why did that key 18%, given that he only won by 77,000 votes and lost by 3 million in the popular vote, what happened there?
These voters were disproportionately Republicans who liked the party, liked Trump's positions on issues, but didn't think that he was necessarily fit for the presidency. They also didn't like Hillary Clinton, but they held off for a very long time, as late as mid-October. Well over half of the voters who didn't like either candidate either had not decided or told pollsters they were voting third party. And I think what happened was in that last week, 10 days, as happens very frequently in American politics, people who think they're going to vote third party can't take the heat and end up coming back to their home party. It's one of the reasons why Al Gore almost beat George Bush despite polling deficits, is that progressives who thought they were going to vote for Ralph Nader in 2000 just couldn't take the heat, and they ended up coming home to the Democrats.
So how do you quantify the populist vote? Because it was very clear throughout the election that candidate Trump was very careful not to alienate Bernie Sanders voters. And a lot of research has been done on those particular voters. And they basically, even if they voted for Trump, they had a lot of affection for Bernie Sanders. So is there any way to quantify that sort of the new populist vote, whether it's left or right? It seems
There's different ways to do it. I think a man named Lee Drutman at New America, a center-left foundation, has done a pretty good job. He has a paper out from last year that defines a populist as somebody who has conservative or leans conservative on questions of identity and social issues, but leans liberal on questions of redistribution and economic interference in the economy. And by that definition, I think he came up with populists being somewhere in the 25 to 30% range of the American public.
And again, I'm speaking with Henry Olson, who's a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and an editor at unheard.com. He's the author of The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue Collar Conservatism, and he has an op-ed at The Guardian, What Liberals Still Get Wrong About Trump's Support. So explain to us, though, how it's the nature of our bipartisan system that is, in a sense, creating this kind of tribalism. In other words, you only have two places to go, right? Is that what it is?
Well, you only have two places to go, and increasingly both sides are not taking position to woo weak members of the other side. You know, you go back to the 1950s or the 1960s, there were liberals and conservatives within both Republicans and Democrats. So if you were angry at one party's leader, you had an acceptable alternative from the other. But that's increasingly not the case. And for Republicans, when you look at Donald Trump, you say, here's the devil that I know, and he's got policies that I like. And I look over at the other side and you see people who you don't view as significantly more ethically superior, and they have policies that you absolutely hate. And that means that you're caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. There's nobody that you can just get your heart behind. So a lot of times Republicans and Republican leaners will stick with the guy who at least they know will deliver the things they care about.
So does that mean then, in terms of because the Democrats don't have a narrative, and they're trying to find one, and they don't seem to have much leadership. And now we're learning about a lot of sort of restiveness at the grassroots with Bernie Sanders going to Kansas with the young woman, Ocasio-Cortez, who surprised everybody and won in a congressional primary in New York's 14th district and even won in a neighboring district, even though she was a right-end candidate. Is it possible then that the Democrats could run people like the conservative Democrat Conor Lamb that they ran in Pennsylvania in a swing district, and then in blue districts run people like Ocasio-Cortez in solid blue districts and not have a unified national message that's going to alienate the conservative Democrats and the disaffected Republicans on the one hand or the progressive Bernie Sanders wing on the other?
Well, I think that's exactly what they're trying to do for this election, is that you had at least 21 House Democratic candidates who have said they're not going to vote for Nancy Pelosi for leader. Of course, all of those are running in swing districts or Republican-leaning districts. The question, though, is when you get to the nominee of a presidential candidate in 2020, you can't split the difference that way. You have to put up one or the other, and it's going to be very difficult to see where somebody like a Conor Lamb is a viable candidate for a Democratic presidential nomination when the energy and the voting base is decidedly at least on the center-left, if not on the left.
But how do the Democrats deal with the structural headwinds that they have? They have to get between 7 and 8% more votes than the Republicans just to break even because of gerrymandering. And the Electoral College clearly favors the Republicans. And there's recent studies that indicate that by 2050, that the red states will have about 60 senators and the blue states, you know, maybe 30 or thereabouts. I know there's 100 in total, but there seems to be some structural headwinds there. And my sense is that unless they win very big in this midterm, and after all, in the last midterm, only one-third of Democrats showed up to vote. And so if they don't win big, not just in terms of House and Senate races, but in terms of state legislatures and governorships, they won't be able to kind of reverse that with the 2020 census. Is that?
I think there's two things going on. One is a gerrymandering question. And the fact is both parties do it. Democrats gerrymandered Illinois and Maryland, but this time Republicans controlled more legislatures, so the net balance is to help the Republicans. You know, I opposed gerrymandering. I opposed gerrymandering back when I got started in politics 30-something years ago, and I oppose it now. One thing that would be helpful would be a genuine bipartisan approach to say, this is a sword that each of us use against each other. Let's basically have strategic arms limitation talks and the gerrymandering. But the larger question is the political coalition, that the reason the Democrats are clumping on the coast is because increasingly they're sending a message that is attractive only to people on the coast. And the people in the center of the country, particularly in the industrial or the old industrial Midwest, are much more moderate. They don't like Republican conservative extremism. They don't like Tea Party Republicans. They don't like Ted Cruz-style religious Republicans, but they also don't like strong progressives. And with Donald Trump, you got somebody who appeared to them to be more centrist, and the Democratic Party that wants to be competitive there and wants to be competitive in those congressional districts needs to appeal to their sensibilities.
But I thought there were demographic structural problems in not just gerrymandering, that people are moving into the urban areas and in cities, and rather than multiply their votes, it tends to reduce their political clout.
Well, that is a problem, is that Democrats are tending, you know, people who are open to Democratic messages are moving to Democratic communities, and those are highly concentrated in the coast or in particular urban areas. So you have Democrats who are at the congressional level or at the Electoral College wasting their votes. You know, like Hillary Clinton won by about 3 million votes. Well, 4 million of that came from California. The additional votes that she wins in California didn't get her a single Electoral College vote. And the same thing at a more granular level is happening in state legislatures and happening in Congress.
So what can be done to address that, because that doesn't sound fair.
Well, the only way that you could address it without changing your coalition is to change the way we elect our people, and that means moving to some sort of popular vote for the presidency rather than the Electoral College. At the congressional level, it means moving towards some sort of proportional representation, probably at a national level rather than a state level, because if you did it by state, you'd have a similar problem. There'd only be so many districts in California, and there's only so many Democratic votes that you can get out of that.
Well, there is, I think. Isn't there some effort underway to have states basically apportion their electoral college representatives based upon the popular vote?
Yes, the National Vote Compact is what it's called. And so far, Connecticut joined it earlier this year. And so far, there's a lot of blue states that have done that. As you can expect, not a single Republican-controlled state has joined the Electoral Vote Compact. But if the Democrats are able to do well in the election and win back a couple of those Midwestern states and push that through, you could very well see this matter going before the Supreme Court to see whether or not the states have the power to make a compact like that. There's competing clauses of the Constitution that would come into play.
So do you accept the notion that we have, in spite of the poll numbers, and Trump's going up to 45% and he's at 88% support amongst Republicans, you still, 45% means that there's still 55% on the other side, whether they're all Democrats or not, I don't know. But could you characterize the situation we have, as some do, as a tyranny of the minority?
I wouldn't use the word tyranny, but, you know, it's very clear that the Trump coalition does not represent a majority of Americans, that the Trump coalition represents a minority of Americans overall and represents a strategically placed minority, which under our system gives them outsized power. It's not to say that Trump couldn't turn that into a majority, but we're 3 years into his political career and he hasn't come close to it yet.
Well, I think as much as his base love him, the Democrats hate him. And, you know, it's extraordinary. The fissure is growing as far as I can tell. And
oh, no, Democrats loathe him with the intensity of a thousand burning suns. But there are, and Democrats are not a Democrat, and Democratic leaners are not a majority. Theoretically, Trump could appeal to independents who don't like him now but are not solid Democrats. But the fact is, those voters have not liked him for 3 years, and there's nothing that suggests he's changing spots. The reason he's president is because he mobilized people who had been Democrats, particularly in the Midwest, to come over to his side, and he basically ran a campaign, what do you care more about, never Hillary or never Trump? And very narrowly in those states, people reluctantly said never Hillary mattered more to them than never Trump. If Trump can do that again in 2 years, he can win again in 2 years. But looking down the road, it's very bad for this country if a majority or plurality continues to lose elections because of oddities of regional distribution or the way we draw our district lines.
Well, it also seems that in many ways politics are being turned on its head. I've never understood why it's not possible on the Democratic side to be both an idealist on domestic policy and a realist on foreign policy. And there are many parts of the American left that have a kind of reflexive blame America first. But there's also this strange phenomenon that's come out because of the sense that there's something going on between Putin and Trump, where traditional Republican red baiters and Soviet haters are now making excuses, if you will, for Putin and Trump, whereas traditionally liberal Democrats who are always suspicious, say, of the CIA, and now kind of hoping that the CIA finds a smoking gun to impeach him. So do you see that having been turned on its head?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that we're seeing changing attitudes. As somebody who's always favored more of a realist approach to foreign policy, I hope that this newfound conversion takes on the Democratic Party. Love to be able to reestablish some degree of bipartisanship on that. On the Republican side, I think there's a lot more wait and see. Is that there's a lot of people, I think, who are wary about what's going on. But so far, it's a lot of smoke. It's a lot of talk. But when Trump actually acts, it's not terribly unlike what a Republican president might have done, such as sending additional defensive arms to the Ukraine to help combat Russian subversion in the Donbass region. So will be interesting to see what those traditional Russia hawks within the Republican Party do if, in fact, Trump does something that would break faith with them. He so far has not. He's isolated his heresies, if you will, to speech and not to action, but that could very well change.
But what do you make then of people like John McCain, Lindsey Graham, Bob Corker? They do have grounding in national security and foreign policy.
They do, and they're highly critical of it. What I was referring to was some of the people that you were making, inferring, are people who in other administrations have been very strong about Russia but are holding fire on the president, as opposed to somebody like a McCain or a Graham or a Corker who have been very consistent both before and after President Trump's election.
So just in closing then, Henry Olson, what's your sense then of what, just briefly, what a Republican strategy will be or could, should be for the midterms? There's this expectation of a blue wave. I'm pretty skeptical of it. And briefly, what do you think is a possible Democratic strategy?
I think there are two types of voters, really three types of voters that need to be focused on. Those are the people who voted for Romney in 2012 and Clinton in 2016. The people who voted for Obama in 2012 and Trump in 2016, and from the Republican side and the Democratic side, the reluctant Trump voter. Republicans need to focus more on the latter two groups. A lot of Romney-Clinton voters just hate Trump, and they're not very open to voting for Republicans anymore. And if I were the Democrats, I think they're doing a good job of talking to those Romney-Clinton voters. But nationally, they're not talking as much to the other types, and that could very well cost them in a number of Senate seats where people who might see Heidi Heitkamp or Claire McCaskill, for example, in one light, but look at a national Democratic Party that's resist, 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 the national mood pushes against the Democrats' ability to appeal to that reluctant Trump or that Obama-Trump voter in states that they absolutely need to have if they're going to be powerful in the Senate.
Well, Henry Olson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Henry Olson, who's a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and an editor at unheard.com. He is the author of The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue-Collar Conservatism. And he has an op-ed at The Guardian, What Liberals Still Get Wrong About Trump's Support. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.